Hello everyone, and welcome to the Rethink Freedom podcast with Freedom United, a podcast dissecting modern slavery around the world with guests on the cutting edge of activism. On this episode, I'm joined by expert speakers on sex work and trafficking to explore strategies to build resilience to trafficking for sexual exploitation. We look at the case for the full decriminalisation of sex work, how this compares to arguments for the partial criminalisation of sex work under what's known as the Nordic model, and how the law can address trafficking whilst also empowering sex workers and ensuring their rights are protected. I'd like to acknowledge that for this episode, we were unable to secure a guest with lived experience of trafficking for sexual exploitation, and so we ask you to bear in mind that this will inevitably limit the breadth of insight in this episode. I'm so pleased to be joined by Charlotte, spokesperson and activist at the English Collective of Prostitutes, a campaigning group which supports the decriminalisation of sex work in the UK and sex workers' right to recognition and safety, Esther Steen, Director of Campaigns at Be Slavery Free, Nadia Whittam, UK Member of Parliament for Nottingham East, Professor Nick May, researcher and expert on migration and sex work at the University of Newcastle, Mariah Grant, Director of Research, Organising and Advocacy at Sex Workers Project, and Megan Hector, activist at Decrim Now. So to get started on the discussion, Esther, I'd like to direct the first question to you. From your perspective, working in the anti-trafficking space in the Netherlands, what has been the impact of legalisation of the sex industry in the Netherlands? And could you briefly explain for people watching what the legalisation of the sex industry means?
Yes. Thanks so much, Miriam. I'm happy that Freedom United is organising this webinar to give more information to their followers. And I want to thank them for giving me the chance to share some of my insights. As all of our time, of course, is limited, I have a bit longer presentation that will be shared in the chat also. For those of you who do not know, in the Netherlands before 2000, buying and selling of sexual services was already legal. However, having a brothel or a legal sex business or pimping was prohibited. So in 2000, they legalized this because it was clear that condoning prostitution had not worked. It created routes for investing dirty money, to let illegal immigrants work dangerously, and to block supervision of the tax department, police, and frontline professionals. It was thought that legalizing the exploitation of the sex industry would solve this. It has been a complete failure, sadly. The only thing that was accomplished is that in the legal sex industry, almost no minors are to be found. All of the other supposed outcomes did not come true at all. This was already made public in research done by the Dutch police in 2007, so 13 years ago. Despite this, a lot of people, including the Dutch public, still think that the legalization was a success. I think that there are several reasons for this. And of course, it's quite normal that you would think if you legalize something that it would be properly regulated. So one of the first things they did is by cancelling the ban on the exploitation of prostitution, illegal businesses built with criminal money and run by criminals were now suddenly legal. It was one of the biggest money laundering operations the Dutch government ever did. The new law did not change these criminals into good ethical businessmen, much to their surprise. The criminal businessmen were not too happy with all the regulations the Dutch government wanted them to comply with. So over two-thirds of the sex businesses that were there in 2000 have now stopped. They have not disappeared, but they have become illegal. And making the exploitation of prostitution legal has put a blanket of snow over the sex industry. So again, this was a business in the Netherlands started with criminal money. By making it legal, it made people assume that it was well regulated and safe, a good place to work. It also condones the exploitation of another person as an object. By law, you are allowed to exploit another as an object. Providing sexual services was now seen as a normal job by our unemployment office. They wanted to force people who had previously were provided sexual services to do this again. The reasoning being that if working in the sex industry was a normal job, then why not go back to working in the sex industry? If they would not do this, they would lose their welfare. One woman took this to court, and a judge said that no one could be forced to take a job in the sex industry, thereby stating it to be not a normal job. Human trafficking has grown to fill the demand that increased because of the legalization of the sex industry. Our police do not have enough budget and staff to do more than control and check the legal businesses. They do not have the resources to check the illegal sex industry. And as I just shared, the illegal sex industry has grown enormously. In the Netherlands, we have at least 3,000 people a year who are likely being sexually exploited. Of those, 1,600 are children. And one of the saddest things, I think, is that it has made life so much easier for human traffickers. They simply have to choose people over 18, and the courts will have a hell of a time to prove that this person was exploited. Our policy is based on giving the police access to victims for prosecution purposes, not to protect victims at all. It's even so horrible that attorneys will advise victims of human trafficking to apply for an asylum instead of declaring themselves victims of human trafficking. To me, the constant framing of survivors as sad little broken girl irks me to no end. That is not at all what my experience is of victims of survivors of sexual exploitation. They are forces to be reckoned with, and they should be the ones helping us decide what our policies should be and shaping our minds on this. I am happy that survivors are also part in this webinar, as they are on the projects on sexual exploitation I am working on.
Thank you, Esther, for setting out that perspective and sharing your views on the impact of legalization of sex work and how that impacted trafficking in the context of the Netherlands. Charlotte, I'd like to pass over to you now, taking a look at your work as part of the English Collective of Prostitutes and the focus on decriminalization of sex work as a means of ensuring sex workers are afforded their rights, and how does that build resilience to exploitation and trafficking. So from your experience, why do you think sex work is sometimes conflated with trafficking, and why can this be harmful?
So hi, everybody. So just a short introduction of what the ECP is. So the English Collective of Prostitutes is a network of sex workers and supporters campaigning for the decriminalization of sex work and money in women's hands. So sex workers in our network work both indoors and outdoors, and we have sister organizations in Thailand and the US. So the conflation of sex work and trafficking is largely spurred on by, in our opinion, the politicians and the media, and also from academics. It appears to be a deliberate strategy to misrepresent the situation, ignore the voices of sex workers, and deliberately lie about the extent of trafficking. And this also fuels sensationalist press coverage, all to justify police crackdowns, increased criminalization, and a tightening of immigration controls to stop women from crossing international borders. So this view actually dismisses sex workers' real life experiences, which is that women go into sex work to be able to make a living for themselves and their families. And a majority of the sex workers are mothers trying to provide for their children and enter the sex industry as a means to be able to provide for themselves because of poverty, austerity, and benefit cuts. And these conditions have been made worse, especially with the pandemic. So conflating sex work with trafficking means that people, starting with labor politicians who will call themselves feminists, can side with the state in a crackdown on prostitution and against women who are struggling to survive. It ignores the fact that women often go into sex work to escape exploitative conditions in other jobs and the degradation of destitution, homelessness, and debt. So conflating trafficking and prostitution actually characterizes sex workers as victims that need to be saved from pimps and exploiters. And this appeals to an elite that thinks that they know better than sex workers and what is good for them, and think that they were destined to be in charge of our lives. The harm caused by anti-trafficking laws and initiatives is ignored. Our point of reference on this is our sister organization, Empower in Thailand, and they published research entitled Hit and Run, the impact of anti-trafficking policy and practice on sex workers' human rights in Thailand, which has largely been ignored, although not by Freedom United, who invited us to write on this issue. So what Hit and Run showed was that trafficking has been used to increase police powers, close borders, mount raid and rescue operations against sex workers and causing great harm. It contains statistics that shows that when police raid, for every person classified as a victim of trafficking, around 6 to 8 non-trafficked migrant sex workers are arrested, detained, and deported. So our sister organization, Empower, also points to the fact that sex workers in Thailand are the main providers for families and communities. It showed that women want to migrate to find better paid work than is available in their home country, but are denied legal ways to travel. In that case, women may pay someone to help with the expectation that they will earn money through sex work to pay off any debt incurred. Restrictions against safe, independent migration should be the foundation of any discussion around trafficking. Trafficking is forced or bonded labor, abduction, kidnapping, false imprisonment, rape, grievous bodily harm, and extortion. And existing laws cover all these offenses that could be used to prosecute the assailants of women and children, whatever work they are being forced into. But what we want to highlight here is that the public's understandable concern for victims of trafficking is being exploited to promote a moralistic and dangerous crusade against prostitution. And this has led to proposals to criminalize men who buy sex, called the Nordic model. This would push prostitution further underground and make sex workers more vulnerable to violence. Decriminalizing sex work will make it easier for victims of trafficking to come forward without fear of arrest and for the police to pursue rapists and traffickers rather than sex workers and clients. So, especially during the pandemic, we see that the lack of recognition of sex work as work has left women in more destitute and vulnerable positions, to which they have to choose between their own health and having money to feed themselves and their children. And it is true that more sex work has moved online in the pandemic, but we must remember that it is the most destitute of women that are still working on the streets, especially with worsening circumstances with regards to poverty. Women have also been deported because sex work was not seen as a legitimate job. But we also must make sure what we mean by legitimacy. When people speak of sex work as legitimate work, they may think of, for example, the system in Amsterdam in which sex work is legalized. We must realize that the system in the Netherlands is ultimately still not what we want, given the legalized system not only means that sex workers have to register with the authorities and make themselves known to the system, but that this creates a system that privileges certain sex workers over others, effectively creating a two-tiered system where there are people working inside the system and outside it, where the women who are working outside it are more vulnerable and not offered the same protections. So for sex work to be recognized as legitimate, we would want it to be decriminalized like any other job as it is in New Zealand. And when we talk about decriminalization, we're not talking about some utopian or unachievable goal, because it has worked and has been working in New Zealand for the past 15 years. It means that sex workers are more likely to report incidents of violence to the police and other agencies, particularly true for street workers. This will also mean a change in the stigma around sex work and that sex workers are entitled to the same protection under the law as anybody else. And women will be more likely to come forward with the information without fear of arrest, making all women safer and finally easier to leave prostitution if and when they want to, as convictions can be cleared for their records. So that's all from me. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Charlotte, for offering your perspectives there. I think what you've set out, you know, the nuances between sex work and trafficking and also the structural issues that underpin the perpetuation of trafficking and how better understanding these can help create more effective responses to trafficking in the industry is very, very important. Mariah, I'd just like to pass on to you now. We've heard a bit about the impact of legalization of the sex industry in the context of the Netherlands and also from Charlotte just now about work in the UK. Could you give an overview of the unique work done at Sex Workers Project in the US to protect the rights of sex workers and also support people who have experienced trafficking?
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to thank Freedom United for this opportunity. As Esta and Charlotte had both mentioned, including people with lived experience in developing policy is something that I fully agree with and is a critical part of the work that we do at the Sex Workers Project of the Urban Justice Center. So we provide legal services to survivors of human trafficking and people who engage in sex work, regardless of whether they do so by choice, circumstance, or coercion. We also engage in research, organizing, and advocacy to build a movement to protect the human rights of sex workers. And this is the work that I oversee with the organization. Our goal in these efforts is to create a world that is safe for all workers and where human trafficking does not exist. We are a unique organization in that we provide both legal services and carry out policy advocacy work throughout the United States. In all we do, we seek to ensure it is trauma-informed and grounded in human rights, harm reduction, and anti-oppression principles. Part of how we do this is to seek guidance from our clients on the policies and laws that we support, as well as to have staff in leadership positions who are current or former sex workers. Based on the direction from people with lived experiences in the sex trades, we support the full decriminalization of the sex industry. So this includes removing penalties for workers and their customers, as well as repealing laws that impede sex workers' ability to make an income. So these would be laws such as prohibiting the promotion of sex work. In the US, most of the laws directly impacting the day-to-day experiences of sex workers are created at the state level. The Sex Workers Project currently supports efforts in New York State to pass legislation that would decriminalize sex work. And as we work towards this goal, we also celebrate incremental wins, including yesterday's historic passage of the repeal of the loitering for the purposes of prostitution law in New York State. The passage of this law, also known as the Walking While Trans ban repeal, was only successful because of the leadership of Black and Brown transgender women who were disproportionately targeted and arrested under the loitering law. We learned from this success and the leadership of those most impacted by laws criminalizing sex work, as we at the Sex Workers Project expand our decriminalization, decarceration, and destigmatization campaigns in other states, including our current Decrim Work campaign in Oregon. There are also local level policies and law enforcement practices that impact the human rights of people in the sex trades. In New York City, we have seen this with the harmful ways the police department's Vice Squad has targeted Black people and other people of color for solicitation arrests and harassed sex workers of color. The numbers demonstrate the racist tactics deployed by the Vice unit, with customer arrest rates in majority Black and Brown neighborhoods being 3 times higher than in majority white neighborhoods, despite sex work happening at comparable rates in each area. The individuals the Sex Workers Project represent verify this reality. They have reported to us incidents of coercive and harassing tactics used by the Vice Squad. At present, our clients are all individuals seeking immigration relief, and an arrest or conviction related to sex work can have a devastating impact on an immigration case. We also see individuals trafficked in the sex trades being the target of arrest or law enforcement intervention by the Vice Squad, an experience that causes undue trauma and further shows the harms of sex work criminalization. There is an over-reliance on and funding for carceral approaches to address trafficking that are not to the benefit of people experiencing trafficking. Instead of funneling millions and millions of dollars to law enforcement, that money would be better spent on services that protect people's human rights and minimize vulnerabilities to exploitation in any industry. This includes funding for social services, housing, and healthcare. We currently work alongside other organizations led by sex workers and impacted communities in calling for the immediate dismantling of NYPD Vice. At the federal level, we track legislation that impacts people in the sex trades to ensure it's not harmful towards sex workers as well as people who have experienced trafficking. While there are many US federal laws that impact people in the sex trades, I will focus on anti-trafficking legislation that is carried out federally, which will allow me to answer one of the other prompts. What are some of the most important points the anti-trafficking sector should keep in mind when working to protect and prevent trafficking into the sex trades? It is critical to understand the history of anti-trafficking efforts in the US and the influence the country has on anti-trafficking approaches globally. Laws and policies meant to address human trafficking in the US are rooted in systems of anti-Blackness and racism more broadly. The Mann Act, also known as the White Slave Trafficked Act of 1910, was used to criminalize and punish Black men for their relationships with white women. At present, we see this history of anti-blackness play out in who is identified as a trafficker. At present, we see this history of anti-blackness. So for example, we are seeing in our work in Oregon that black men are extremely overrepresented as federal defendants in trafficking cases in the sex trades. So from data from 2017, among 18 trafficking cases, 85% of Oregon federal defendants were black men, despite only about 3% of Oregon residents identifying as black. Research is also beginning to show that women are disproportionately prosecuted for federal sex trafficking offenses in the United States. Organizations that seek clemency for women who have been incarcerated for crimes related to their own trafficking have identified a pattern that women of color specifically are being prosecuted at higher rates than their white counterparts. We too see this in our work at the Sex Workers Project, that there is a disparity along racial lines that determines who is identified as a victim of trafficking and who is identified as a trafficker. And that ultimately, anti-trafficking models that rely on law enforcement interventions perpetuate cycles of violence instead of preventing violence from happening. The harms of prosecution-focused approaches to trafficking in the US also impact countries around the world. The US is a major funder of anti-trafficking programs globally, and it produces an influential report each year ranking many countries' efforts to end human trafficking. So that's the Trafficking in Persons report put out by the State Department. In ranking these countries, the US relies heavily on prosecution rates, thus perpetuating the emphasis on carceral approaches to anti-trafficking. Ultimately, we at the Sex Workers Project and many other human rights organizations see the imprisonment of people as the go-to means to end trafficking as antithetical to protecting people's human rights. But as a society, we have relied so heavily on punishment through imprisonment that some people with lived trafficking experiences deeply believe that the sex work decriminalization model is in conflict with stopping abuses in the sex trades. Given our historical reliance on incarceration as the ultimate form of justice, that viewpoint is understandable. This belief also reflects the failing of the anti-trafficking industry to focus on stopping harm in the first place and engaging approaches that uplift the dignity of sex workers and protect the human rights of everyone involved in the sex trades, whether it be by choice, circumstance, or coercion. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mariah. It's so valuable to hear about the work that you're doing at Sex Works Project and the intersection of supporting people who have experienced trafficking as well as working to protect the rights of sex workers. We're really glad to be joined by Nadia Whittam, UK Labour Member of Parliament for Nottingham East. Thank you so much, Nadia, for making time to join this discussion today. So the Sexual Exploitation Bill in the UK had its first reading in December. Nadia, can you explain a bit for people watching what the bill means for sex workers and why it could be harmful to people in the sex industry?
Thanks so much, Miriam, and thank you for holding this extremely important seminar. I'm really looking forward to hearing from everyone else on it. So the Sexual Exploitation Bill basically conflates two separate issues. It conflates sex trafficking and sex work. Now, I understand that many colleagues who are supporting this bill are doing so with the best of intentions, but it would make it a crime for sex workers' clients to pay for sex. It would also create new criminal offences relating to enabling or profiting from another person's sexual exploitation. It would also criminalise the advertising of sex services online, where sex workers can advertise safely and screen clients. So things like NUM, National Ugly Mugs, which operates in the UK, would be very difficult to access or even criminalised. I think it would be fair to say that the underlying assumption of the bill is that sex work exists because of demand. But of course, we all know that the majority of sex workers enter the sex industry for socioeconomic reasons, because of universal credit, of benefits cuts, of low work and exploitation in other work. And all of this would be unchanged by reduction in demand. I wanted to talk a little bit as well about, I know that this will be covered by other speakers, but arguments for the Nordic model and why we know from evidence that just isn't the case, that evidence suggests from other countries that where similar legislation has been introduced, that that's led to an increase in the exploitation of sex workers, not a decrease. And even though it says that it's criminalising the buyer and decriminalising sex workers in those countries are still routinely arrested. Amnesty International, of course, said that internationally the criminalisation of buyers has made worse the violence and stigma against sex workers. There was also a report by Médecins du Monde, which was cited by my colleague Lynn Brown when she spoke against this bill, speaking to sex workers in France, where they said the same, that overall that this has had a detrimental impact on sex workers' safety, health, living conditions. It's increased poverty, especially amongst people already living precariously, and particularly for undocumented migrant women, which is not just an issue in France, but also in this country where we have something called no recourse to public funds, which means that if you're undocumented, or if you're an asylum seeker, you don't have access to public money. So you can't access benefits, for example. So this bill will make sex workers less safe. It would push the sex industry underground, and it would basically criminalise some of those safeguarding measures that currently exist. So I mentioned earlier that sex workers would be less able to screen their clients. It would be likely that clients would start doing things to make them more undetectable, like switching SIM cards, refusing to disclose their real numbers because they fear prosecution. And of course, that would make it harder for sex workers to identify clients who might pose a danger to them, or would be more likely to pose a danger to them. It would criminalise, so it's already a criminal offence for people to work together. It would criminalise that, which is one of the biggest things that keeps sex workers safe. So sex workers would be forced to meet clients in private, working in spaces alone that are away from law enforcement. Not that law enforcement always keeps sex workers safe. We know that there is internationally a very high rate of violence perpetrated by law enforcement towards sex workers, but that's perhaps a slightly different issue. And I think the really key thing on the point of trafficking is that it makes sex workers more susceptible to trafficking, and it makes it more difficult to find victims of trafficking because of that false conflation. So what can MPs do? What can the public do to help? And what can our constituents do? I think it's really important that MPs are hearing the voices of sex workers, because as allies, we're in an important position to be able to amplify those voices in the House of Commons, in the media, on social media. So I would urge anyone to write to your MP and tell them why they should oppose this bill, because as members of Parliament, we're not experts on anything, and we're certainly not experts on everything. You know, we've got our areas of interest and expertise, but lots of people won't know a lot about this bill and will perhaps listen to the information that they're presented with. And if that is that this is what sex workers want, this is what will keep people safe, then they would probably support the bill. But that's why it's important for you to contact your MP. And I think really importantly, particularly if you are a sex worker yourself, encourage your MP to meet with sex workers themselves, so that they can hear directly from them what the issues are, and what we need to be doing in Parliament to legislate. Because for Labour MPs, not every MP would take this view, but sex workers are workers and we are the party of workers. We're here to represent every worker in our constituency and in this country, the whole class of workers, and that includes sex workers. But also, even if you don't take that view, we are here to represent every single one of our constituents. So I'd recommend that you urge your MP to meet with them, but also groups like the Royal College of Nursing, which is pro-decriminalisation, WHO, UN Human Rights Organisations, Amnesty, the BMA Junior Doctors are also pro-decrim. And I'd say when you're speaking to your MP, ask them instead to target the root causes which push people into sex work. And I don't say that to undermine the fact that not everybody feels pushed into sex work, but of course, a large number of people do. And the conditions and the causes which prevent people from leaving if they want to, and of course not everybody would want to. And I'd encourage them, particularly if you have a Conservative MP, to target benefit sanctions and demand increase in universal credit and other state benefits, because the link between that and sex work is so clear. But if there's one thing that you can do, I would platform and amplify the work of organisations like Decrim Now, English Collective of Prostitutes, Ugly Mugs, the Sex Worker Advocacy and Resistance Movement. If you live in Nottingham, then the Prostitute Outreach Workers, who do an amazing job in our city, and join their campaigns and really amplify their demands. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Nadia, for that incredibly helpful overview of the bill, how its passage into law could affect people in the sex industry and put people potentially at greater risk of trafficking. And it was also really helpful to get an overview of what the Nordic model approach looks like. I'd like to pass on to you now, Nick, to take a look at some of your findings through your research on migration, borders and sex work and how this relates to anti-trafficking efforts. So through your research, what were some of the reasons you found for migrants pursuing sex work as a means of survival? And how do you think interventions aimed at helping victims of trafficking, such as brothel raids, could actually further endanger migrant victims of trafficking?
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Miriam, for this question. Thank you, Freedom United, for inviting me. I also want to congratulate Mariah in New York for the abrogation of the Walking White Trans law. It was an incredible victory, which means a lot to a lot of people who really are marginalized in very structural ways at the intersection of race, gender, and it was a great, a beautiful piece of news in quite a gloomy situation. So wonderful. Today I'm going to talk a little bit about the results as a way of answering your questions of my latest project, which is called Sex Hum. It's a project funded by European Research Council, which takes place in four countries which are strategic for the things we're talking about today. They are Australia, France, New Zealand, and the United States. In the United States, we looked at LA and New York. And in New Zealand, of course, we looked at the whole country. In Australia, we looked at New South Wales and Victoria, where sex work is specifically decriminalized in New South Wales and regulated in Victoria. And the United States, of course, we've already heard from Mariah, so there's no need for me to tell you that it's a very heavily criminalized environment. In France, we collaborated with Doctors of the World, and the report that was mentioned before was one of the outputs of the project. So the field within which we are trying to discuss decriminalization and its opportunities for the fight against trafficking is one which is characterized by politicized and political understandings of people's position in the sex industry. The very language it is used often is quite loaded. In the last 20 years, the neo-abolitionist movement has occupied the language space by even introducing the form of commercial, phrases like commercial sexual exploitation, or equating sex work as sexual exploitation, which is something that is becoming quite pervasive in policymaking. And this is very confusing when people try to understand what needs to be done about trafficking. The majority of the people we interviewed across the four countries see sex work as their occupation. They see it as work, which seems to be a very intuitive and banal remark, but actually it's from this approach that everything else follows, because if we then follow them in the way, in the reasons why they migrated, we can see a plurality of reasons, including escaping poverty, as has been touched on before, but also accessing international mobility. For some people, sex work is the only job they can have because they are undocumented. For some populations, because they are stigmatized and marginalized, and I'm thinking here about trans women of color in the US, sex work is one of the few occupations that can actually accept them. And there is also a relationship between sex work and mental health, because for a lot of people who suffer from mental health, sex work is an occupation that can accommodate their needs rather than a more mainstream occupation. This is flipping the other way around, in which the situation is always being seen as in terms of sex work generating mental health issues. A very broad variety of reasons. I think that if there's one recommendation that needs to be done, of course, is that whatever anti-trafficking intervention take place, they should be separated from the law enforcement of migration law. This is something that is the takeaway message for me, for policymakers. And of course, the findings of the research, they strongly support decriminalization of all parties involved as the least harmful policymaking framework to address the needs and the lives and rights of migrant sex workers and non-migrant sex workers. I think it's very important to also make distinctions that are drawn very easily, but for very political reasons. Sometimes legalization and decriminalization are equated. This is wrong conceptually and de facto, because decriminalization is a very different framework. And it does not, and it is preferred by sex workers and sex worker activists, exactly because of the reason that Esther, drew when she discussed the Dutch case. It's because any attempt to decriminalize, to criminalize or to legalize the sex industry will inevitably, invisibilize and push underground the most marginalized and vulnerable sectors. And this is particularly true with migrants. I also wanted to, I don't want to repeat what has already been said by Charlotte and Nadia and Maria before me. And so what I would like to emphasize here is that we chose particularly the comparison between New Zealand and Australia, and particularly New South Wales, because although New Zealand has a very comprehensive law, also decriminalizing street sex work, which is not the case to the same extent in New South Wales. In New Zealand, migrants on temporary visas cannot work in the sex industry because of Section 19 of the Prostitution Reform Act. This means that although in New Zealand and in Australia there are very few cases of trafficking in the sex industry, in New Zealand, migrants working in the sex industry, they experienced more exploitative conditions than in New South Wales. So if I could advocate for a model that is best practice in the world, it would be the one of New South Wales, because migrants on short-term contracts can actually, for example, students who can work 20 hours in whatever sector, they can also work 20 hours in the sex industry a week, and which means that they are above respecting the law, and they can therefore fight whatever kind of exploitation they meet in their in their work. This is a very important contribution, and I also think that anti-trafficking, we documented the so-called collateral damage that is produced by anti-trafficking interventions across the four countries, and anti-trafficking is unfortunately one of the findings of the project is that anti-trafficking projects and policies tend to be embedding mechanism for anti-migration and anti-sex work policies and interventions. There's very few people who will say we need to crack down on sex work, we need to crack down on migration, except of course in under the Trump administration, very, very directly. But everybody will say we need to intervene against trafficking. This means that this discourse and these practices are unfortunately shadowing very brutal ways to enforce the law and deportation. And so it's very important to when you listen to migrants, what overwhelmingly comes out is that anti-trafficking is part of their problem and not of their solution for a vast majority of people, because it exposes them to immigration controls and therefore to the threat of deportation. And it's very important to understand that from a migrant studies and from a migration perspective, remaining present on the country of emigration is existentially more important than almost anything, because people migrate to support their families, to support themselves. Often they have paid a fortune in order to arrive in the country of destination. They are responsible for families and children, and therefore, the last thing they want and or can do is to jeopardize this already very vulnerable position. So I don't know whether I have taken too much space. I'll stop here, and then I'm happy to to answer any question afterwards.
Thank you so much, Nick, for just going over your work. So I know that there's a lot more to say about this piece of research. I'm just keeping an eye on the time, and we also want to give our audience members a chance to ask some questions. We've been receiving quite a few. So I'll go straight on to you, Megan. Just thinking about your work at DCRIM now, how do you think anti-trafficking laws have been used to put migrants in the sex industry, as Nick's already addressed, at risk of deportation? And do you think there is growing political support for decriminalisation of sex work in the UK?
Yeah, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to speak. I'm speaking on behalf of DCRIM Now, the UK campaign for the full decriminalisation of sex work. So to answer your second question first, we know that there's strong support for the decriminalisation of sex work, or DCRIM, at the grassroots level and from civil society, from human rights organisations to the HIV sector, international labour organisations, public health organisations, and some anti-trafficking organisations as well. The Liberal Democrats and the Green Party have long had DCRIM as their party's policy. And thanks to grassroots campaigning, 12 constituency Labour parties have now passed a motion in support of the DCRIM of sex work. And the affiliated group LGBT Labour has also endorsed DCRIM and voted to campaign for the policy within the party. Recently, we helped to organise a drive for people to write to their MP, as Nadia mentioned, to ask them to oppose the 10-minute rule bill proposed by Diana Johnson, which would criminalise various aspects of sex work, further endangering already vulnerable sex workers. Some of the emails that were sent in response to those constituents by MPs, who we know to be historic supporters of the Nordic model, seem to show less enthusiasm or support for the model than we might have expected, which might be cause for cautious optimism. However, it is a long and slow road to convince more politicians of the benefits of DCRIM, despite the wealth of international evidence on this, such as research by Amnesty, the World Health Organization, UNAIDS, etc., and Nick's research, and the power of sex workers' voices, which we have behind us. Obviously, there are a handful of MPs who are vocally pro-DCRIM, Nadia included, which we're very lucky to have, but it's not a particularly popular topic for politicians to take a stance on. However, over the last few years, sex workers' rights have increasingly been seen as a part of migrant struggles, and workers struggles for rights, as they should be. And we want to keep building on that momentum. So we need grassroots allies and civil society organisations to step up and support DCRIM. Talk about it with your friends, your family, your local MP, your union and your political party. Great. But to move on to your first question, and kind of building on what Nick said. So police forces around the UK use anti-trafficking laws to justify raiding suspected brothels in search of victims of trafficking. But in practice, victims of trafficking are rarely found during these raids. However, migrant sex workers are often subject to being taken into immigration detention and deported against their will. During raids, women can have their phones and cash earnings seized and permanently confiscated as the proceeds of crime. They can be subjected to being questioned by police while in a state of undress or taken to a police station without a chance to get fully dressed. In some cases, local reporters have been invited to witness raids. I'm going to give a few examples of these kind of things happening. So in October 2016, police raided six massage parlours in London's Chinatown as part of Operation Lanhydrock. The police told reporters that the aim of the raid was to rescue victims and take them to a place of safety. In fact, the police seized cash from women's lockers, made 24 arrests, none of which were for trafficking offences, 17 of which were for immigration offences, and ultimately deported 13 people, mostly women. In 2017, Wiltshire Police raided a Swindon flat and announced that they would make sure that any cases of human exploitation are prioritised and the victims removed to safety. The idea that the victims would be taken to safety speaks to the way in which these raids are presented to the public as about prioritising care for the women caught up in them. However, the three Romanian women who the police arrested were simply deported. Deportation is a distressing, or sometimes violent, experience. Deportation tears people away from their community and support networks and from their source of income. What's more, women held in detention centres while awaiting deportation are put at serious risk of physical and sexual violence. A 2015 Channel 4 investigation showed guards at Yarlswood Detention Centre ignoring women's self-harm and referring to women using racist terms. A number of women held at the centre have also alleged experiencing sexual abuse by guards. Even when people are officially recognised as trafficking victims through the national referral mechanism, material and legal support for them to settle in the UK and escape poverty is frequently absent or inadequate. Trafficking victims can still be subject to forced deportations from the UK, regardless of what further danger awaits them in their home country. The deportation of undocumented or insecurely documented migrants, whether trafficked or not, has the effect of producing conditions which lead to trafficking. When undocumented migrants are justifiably fearful of attracting the attention of the state, they are unable to seek recourse for exploitation and are intensely vulnerable to harm. The UK is spending significant resources dedicated to trafficking and modern slavery on flawed criminal justice operations, while dangerously neglecting the social spending that can achieve real long-term positive outcomes for victims. A rights-based and victim-centred approach to trafficking policy would fund holistic, long-term provision of the services trafficking victims need to rebuild their lives. Legal assistance, housing and benefits, compensation, trauma-informed counselling, and language and employment support, for example. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Megan. That's a really helpful overview of the work done by DCRIM now. We just have 10 minutes left. Esther, I would briefly like to just throw this back to you because we have covered a lot about decriminalisation, and I'd just like to give you an opportunity to present, perhaps why you think decriminalisation of sex work may not be the most effective way to prevent trafficking for sexual exploitation. But if we could just keep it just as a few minutes.
I'll try and short as possible. Yeah. So first off, I've been researching this topic for 9 years, so I've spent a lot of time thinking about it. I think that decriminalization of selling sexual services should always be legal. It should be the standard in every country. I am not for decriminalization of the entire sex industry because it will give free rein to pimps and traffickers. It makes it extremely hard for law enforcement to prosecute cases. They have to prove that exploited people were forced. If pimping is illegal, it becomes that much easier to protect those at risk of sexual exploitation or those being sexually exploited. And there's one thing I have to say In all my years of researches and all the people I spoke to, there is not any law that's been put in place in any country or in any place that has been able to stop and prevent sexual exploitation. The sex industry is rife with criminals who want to make as much money as possible. And besides this, the general public does not see people providing sexual services as people that need to be respected. And I think if that issue is not being addressed, and in my longer presentation, you can find what do I mean with the fact, but the fact that there's no respect for people who provide sexual services. So whether you see them as victims or as people doing this voluntarily, this means that they are more easily harmed because people do not respect them. And I think that's what needs to be targeted. So if you look at the Swedish model, and the only reason why it was successful in Sweden is because they spent millions and millions of money on training and educating frontline professionals, youth, police, social workers. And because of that, gender equality has improved a lot in Sweden. And that has had an enormous impact. And I would say whatever policy the UK chooses, it should reflect a view on humans that is helpful to survivors and those providing sexual services voluntarily, while keeping in mind that the vast majority of people providing sexual services did not start doing this voluntarily and are not doing this voluntarily now. To me, the rights of victims and protecting those most at risk should be the most important thing in whatever policy you come up with. To put it really extreme, is the policy that you choose keeping those most at risk safe?
Now, our guests speak to the Freedom United community and answer some common questions on sex work and trafficking. Our first question: in the wake of Brexit, won't European sex workers in the UK be suddenly rendered far more vulnerable still, and what can be done to protect them? Charlotte, I know that the ECP released a report last year on the impact of Brexit, so perhaps you'd like to say something on that.
Yeah, so with Brexit, there has already been kind of a very hostile immigration environment when it came to immigration policy in general, but this especially was true for sex workers. I mean, I would say that the vulnerability was not unique to a pre or post Brexit thing, and that it was already there. But yes, especially with Brexit, a lot of European sex workers, especially in our network, have been the targets of deportation and of police violence. Because as has been already mentioned many times by the other speakers, that I would say that prostitution acts as an axis to which a lot of other kind of convictions can be built on. And so now with that kind of, with Brexit being the kind of social climate, it only fuels a further incentive to persecute these women on multiple lines, starting with prostitution convictions, but also moving on towards deportation in the case of a lot of the migrant sex workers in our network.
Thank you, Charlotte, for that answer. Our next question is, what effective or good examples are there of supporting victims of modern slavery who have experienced sexual exploitation? It can be incredibly difficult to identify women and men who identify as victims. So what models are working effectively? Perhaps Mariah, through your work, you can speak to that.
In terms of identifying individuals, I think having honest discussions about what is exploitation is important, so that people can know what their rights are in terms of any industry that they work in, and if their rights are being abused, whether that be in the sex trades or if they're working at a restaurant, that they can self-identify that the working conditions they're under are not appropriate and are not meeting the laws within the country that they reside in. I think it also needs to be a conversation that is being had in different areas of work. So whether that be with social workers, with the medical field, that there's an understanding of what trafficking is and that it can happen in any industry, and the signs of trafficking so that people can assist in that identification, but have it be really an honest conversation about what those signs are. There's a lot of sensationalism around training on human trafficking, which leads to incorrect identification, or people on airplanes. We see this happen in the US where people have been trained to identify trafficking and they actually end up just profiling people. So they'll profile a parent and a child who appear to be of a different ethnic background and say that they're concerned about trafficking. So we end up seeing it being really distorted and actually causing further harm. So I think that the training that happens around human trafficking has to be grounded in evidence and reality. I also think that changing kind of the perception, I know we have limited time, but changing perceptions around sexuality and being comfortable talking about sex is actually a preventative mechanism so that people, when they're experiencing exploitation in the sex trades, would be able to identify that is harmful. I know that we can move on to another question.
Thank you, Mariah. I think we have time for just one or two more questions. So we received a question: what will happen to adultwork.com if the sexual exploitation bill is passed? I am an escort on there, and we've heard if this bill passes, adultwork.com will be taken down. Perhaps Nadia or Megan or Charlotte can speak to that. Megan, I don't know if
you know. I can go. Yes, I think it might be helpful to make clear, perhaps Nadia can be a bit clearer about the reasons why, but the bill is not likely to pass. Second readings of bills have been cancelled for the foreseeable future. So I just want to kind of make sure that people aren't unnecessarily worried about that. But yes, the impact of banning advertising of sexual services would mean that adult work would be closed. And we've seen from similar foster sester laws in the US that this has a really negative impact on sex workers. In fact, independent workers who were kind of managing themselves have been driven back into the arms of what people might refer to as pimps, because they are struggling then to find work. So it's really negative. And also police forces in the US have mentioned that it made it more difficult for them to find victims, real victims of sex trafficking, by taking away that advertising platform. So there's just a few answers.
Thank you, Megan. That's really helpful. It's really helpful to just give that clarification that the bill is not likely to pass at this stage. I'd just like to thank all of our speakers, Nadia Whittam, Esther Steen, Professor Nick May, Megan Hector, Mariah Grant and Charlotte for taking part in what has been really enlightening discussion. Thank you to all of our fantastic speakers and the Freedom United community for this insightful and passionate discussion on the decriminalisation of sex work as a means to building resilience to trafficking. Freedom United supports the full decriminalisation of sex work as a necessary component to any sustainable anti-trafficking strategy. We believe that negating the crucial difference between consensual sex work and crimes like human trafficking risks undermining trafficking prevention strategies and the successful identification and protection of trafficking survivors. To learn more about the work Freedom United is doing to support global calls for the decriminalisation of sex work, visit our dedicated resource page at freedomunited.org/trafficking-sexual-exploitation. Thanks everyone, and stay tuned for the next episode.